This is my third speech in Prague, indeed. So I've been giving a presentation in October and in December. Okay, so welcome to, well, repeat all that stuff that Lukasz said in English. I'm going to talk today about a part of Solaris that, well, needs very much work, but has very few people actually contributing to it, and that is writing file systems for the Solaris operating system. So file system drivers are very much different, as we're going to see, from hardware device drivers, character and block device drivers for actual physical hardware. We know that the latter one, hardware device drivers, are very well documented, and Solaris has interfaces to support these, called the DDI, pretty well. There are courses how to write hardware device drivers on Solaris, but file systems are extremely different there. A file system doesn't need to interface directly with the hardware. Instead, it just calls I/O functions in order to perform access to the physical storage. So the file system driver is a client of a generic block device driver, and as such does not use many of those well-documented DDI functions. It has a need to call an entirely different set of utility functions, and of course a file system device driver provides an entirely different set of entry points compared to a hardware device driver. So we're going to look at the source code structure, what makes up a file system in Solaris, what do you need, user space utilities, kernel drivers, how is the source code organization, and after that we're going to look at the actual implementation, what do you need to do in order to create code that can be linked into a Solaris file system that runs as a Solaris file system. What are the different routines that you need to fill in? Where and where does the glue code and the more or less skeleton code end and the file system specific code start? The actual interfacing with file system specific on-disk data structures, and how are you dealing with these? I'm going to show source code examples during the presentation that are mostly taken from the UFS and the PCFS file systems. Neither of which is a perfectly perfect example how to start writing a file system. Unfortunately, there is no perfect example how to start writing a file system. The interfaces within the Solaris kernel that you call when you want to write a file system are not perfectly stable. They're not changing from release to release in a completely incompatible fashion, but they at least change between Solaris releases in such fashions that you cannot create file system modules that load both into Solaris 8 and into Open Solaris, while that is not a problem for a hardware device driver, for example. So what I'll talk about is the actual current Open Solaris interface. And the source code quotes that I'm going to show reflect the state in Open Solaris as of today. You will not be able to write a file system for Solaris 8 or 9 given these things, because some of the source code needs to look different there. But then, is anyone writing file systems for anything previous than Open Solaris? Well, Veritas is, and I pity them for it. So, a file system in Solaris is made up from the kernel driver, a set of header files, so mostly declaring the on-disk data structures and these kind of things, and a set of user space utilities. The file system driver itself interacts with the frameworks for file system instantiation, which is VFS, so the virtual file system switch, that's what it stands for, actually allows you to perform operations like create a file system instance and discard a file system instance, or in more commonly known terms, mount and unmount things. While the next thing that you need to interface with are the VNode operations that operate on, well, entities within a file system, meaning files, directories, nodes in general. And the VNode operations are just backends for the usual Unix file interfaces. So from a very, very high-level point of view, there is a Unix operation that operates on a file descriptor, and when performing the system call, it will end up with a VNode operation being called. The mapping is not perfectly one-to-one, but close, as we are going to see. Now, the actual implementation of the kernel driver needs to use for I/O and for interfacing with the system's page cache functions from the virtual memory management subsystems that are not documented. So for generic device drivers, well, how to do DMA, how to do memory copy to or from user land buffers, all of this is documented. But how to memmap a file, for example, how to update the contents of a page within the system's page cache, how to even locate a page in the system's page cache if you know what VNode it belongs to and what file offset it belongs to, is something that is done by using undocumented parts of the VM subsystem. I'm going to show some of these as far as we need them in order to actually implement I/O, memmapped I/O in Solaris as file systems do. Other parts that are undocumented, which I can only skim glancingly, is the way how the buffer cache works. Well, Solaris has a buffer cache that is used for caching actually metadata information, not user data. So the user data in Solaris is in the page cache. It's all done and all dealt with by VM. It's only metadata which ends up in a special separate cache. It's simple to use. We're going to see examples of that. And another undocumented subsystem is how do you interface with the directory name lookup cache. These are generic services that file systems can use. And those of you who are somewhat familiar with other operating systems might notice that there are things missing in here. What, for example, is missing? Well, we do not have a generic interface for transaction support or so. So not like Linux, where you have the JohnLink block device driver thingy, nothing like that in Solaris. There's no generic quota support. There is no really generic or perfectly generic ACL support. So all these kind of things, which are file system functionality and are to be used by file systems, actually need to be provided in Solaris by a file system-specific implementation. Why is this so? Well, mostly because Solaris, the major file system on Solaris all the time has been UFS, which had all those bells and whistles, and the other ones were more or less neglected add-ons. So we don't have a huge variety of file systems in Solaris, and hence the drive to actually unify code and create a better framework and keep code common where it could stay common has not been there in Solaris. We're going to see some example of that, especially regarding the interfacing with the page cache and the page fault handling via file systems. File system utilities, I'm not going to talk about how to write file system utilities today. You need a full set of file system utilities, at least mount and unmount, and maybe FSCK or MKFS in order to properly use a Solaris file system together with the generic commands. Because the generic commands in Solaris, mounts, unmount, FSCK, MKFS, they're just taking a parameter that says this file system type and something else, and this something else just gets passed through a file system specific utility. Now, in order to use those things, you have to provide them. So how does the source code look like? Well, you have three parts of the source code: a kernel driver that, in an open Solaris source code hierarchy, lives under user source UTS for the kernel parts, common FS, and then a subdirectory for your stuff. You have a set of headers. They are not usually living in the same place. They instead traditionally are stored under sysfs in user source UTS common. You have a set of user space utilities, and the user space utilities come from user source cmd fs.d slash the name of your file system. When you compile it, when you install it, it ends up in the kernel driver being kernel fs, name of your file system. The headers in user include sysfs, and the utilities actually in user libfs, ufs. This is where the kernel expects file system drivers to be. And this is where the user space utilities, the wrappers for mkfs, fsck, fstype, mkfs, mount, unmount, where the main wrapper function utilities expect the file system backend utilities to be. I'll talk about the kernel driver. So let's start with the source code layout. And what kind of sources have we? How do we name them? Traditionally, there has been a certain naming convention for file system drivers that puts the declaration of superblock data structures and the definitions of bit fields, flag fields, and the meaning of these kind of things, structural metadata of the file system into name of the file system underscore fs.h. That's how UFS does it, and everyone in a certain degree has copied this information from UFS. So you have this underscore fs.h header file for almost all the file systems. Likewise, for the on-disk layout of directory entries and related metadata information, you have an fsdir.h file. And for the declaration of how node data structures look like, inodes, you have the inode.h header file. In UFS, inode.h is actually the central header file because it does not only contain the information for the on-disk layout for what an inode, file system node in UFS is, but it also contains most of the in-core data structures. So the file system driver's representation of a file system instance, struct UFS VFS, is in there. The file system driver's in-core representation of an inode with all the logs and all the associated data is in there. Well, other file systems often also provide a subr.h header for generic glue code. Like PCFS puts file name, case conversion code, and timestamp conversion code in there. It's just being called by many places in the file system. UFS doesn't have one of these. Instead, it has a huge bunch of, well, specific purpose headers. Almost all file systems have the first three, and it's probably a good idea when you write a new one to keep those, name them as you name your file system, and put those informations in there, because kind of it looks the way like everything looks like. There is usually more than that. UFS overall uses around 20 header files or so. ZFS uses way, way more than that. How you name them, what you put in there, is entirely implementation specific. You could, if you're extremely lazy, create just one header. Just create a myfs.h, put everything in there. No one would mind. I mean, that's a question of how your code is organized. It's just a question of letting other people become familiar with your file system quicker if it follows the usual conventions. The same is true for the actual file system driver code. File system driver code. There are two that you should always have because they are kind of mandated by the framework, and that's the VFSOps and the VNODOps file. So the VFSOps and the VNODOps file are actually the main skeleton of the file system code because they contain the VFSOps.c file contains the actual module linkage code for a file system module, and the interface to the VFS. And the vnodeops.c source file contains the actual, well, vnode operations wrappers. The implementation, the file system specific implementation, usually is just called by these wrappers and resides in a node.c file and a dir.c file. So in UFS case, in the UFS case, VFSOps and VNODOps interface with the framework, contain the skeleton code and the module glue code. Well, the actual implementation of these will be something like UFS open calls UFS IOpen. That's a traditional structure. In detail, not every VNODOP interface needs a backend. Not every VFSOP needs a backend. It can be simple enough that everything is inlined just in the VNODOPs and VFSOPs.c file. We will see more about that. There's more what you have in file systems and what many file systems share, and that is VMAP and alloc. What do these two source files provide? They provide the information for how to map a file offset to a disk block or a sequence of disk block numbers. That's the main task of a file system, because a file is just a sequence of bytes. Where it is actually stored on disk is for a file system to figure out. And these block mapping routines are in vmap.c. And likewise, if you don't have a read-only file system but a read-write file system, you need to be able to, well, grow and shrink files, extend and truncate. So this requires block allocation and block free handling, and that's stuck into alloc.c. Almost all file systems, again, share this thing and have some of the functions that I'll show for UFS. What else is there? Well, file system specific stuff, lots of it, which is different for everyone then. Okay, so how do the core handles to file systems, file system instances with the VFS and file nodes with the VNodes, how do these work? Well, the generic VFS data structure contains a function ops table, which is just this VFS ops structure. And so you can mount file systems, unmount. You can find out what the root node of the file system is. So do a lookup on what slash what the mount point actually is. You can do a stat VFS on it. You can do a VGET on it. We'll talk about that in a moment. Mount root is something special. If you want to use a file system as a root file system, needs to be able to deal with some special requirements. Free VFS, well, after unmounting the VFS, you still might have some data hanging around, or the unmount might be asynchronous or forced, whatever. The time when you really can free all remaining information associated with a file system instance is when free VFS is called. Oops. VN state, this is for interfacing with file event monitoring, stuff like that. It is not necessary for a file system to provide all of these. You can get away with just mount, unmount, root, and VGET. Would have a functional file system, except that, of course, some things wouldn't properly work. Most file systems do only provide the first six. VNodes, what kind of operations can you perform on file nodes? Well, if we read through those and we see that they are very close to actual Unix system calls, open files, close files, read from a file, write to a file, perform an ioctl on a file descriptor, setfl, we don't know what that does. No one uses it, obviously. Get attribute, set attribute, Well, what do? They provide the backend for functions like stat, or view times, or change own, change mod. VOP access, well, the backend for the access system call. VOP lookup. VOP lookup is used in order to identify what is the VNode that belongs to this file name in this directory. Create a file, remove a file from a directory, create a link, create a symlink, rename, whatever. All of these pretty much match operations that we know, except this one is strange here, VOP inactive. VOP inactive is special, and I'll talk about that a little later. And what else is not like normal file IO? Well, get page, put page, VOP map, VOP add map, VOP del map. What are these for? Well, they provide the backends for memapped file access. Memap a file, unmap a file, perform memapped IO, meaning create page faults and handle them. And in fact, the core functions in a file system that do the actual disk IO to user data, the read from disk and the write to disk, are not read and write, but they are get page and put page. What else? Pull, you know, dump. What is dump for? If you want to be able to write crash dumps to a file system, you need to have this function. Page IO if you want to have swap files. Setsec adder, getsec adder, that's ACL interfacing. That table is huge, but again, if you implement a file system, you have the options to say, get me the default behavior for this thing, which is enot sub, eInval, eIO. Don't do anything, just return an error. So what else do you need once you created the functions that you want to pass on as VFSOps, VNOps? You need to tell the framework, hey, I'm a file system driver. Would you mind registering my functions op vectors? And would you mind calling my functions op vectors if you have a request, say, to mount a file system of that type? What you do is you have, like for normal block and character device drivers, the module data structure, and the module data structure tells you how to initialize the module. So you have a mod linkage, like for all loadable drivers in Solaris. And for a file system device driver, it looks like this, modref1, a pointer to the mod LFS structure, and a null. The mod LFS structure contains, well, the address of this mod FSOps variable here, which is actually a global within the framework code. So this is not part of your stuff. A string that describes what kind of file system this is, and a virtual file, I don't know what the W actually stands for, another data structure. And this other data structure is a VFS definition. As a VFS definition, it says the name of my file system is UFS. The function that you should call when you load this file system module is UFS init. And it has prototypes for VFS operations. And it supports remount. There are some more those switches that you can do. What else do you pass in there? Another piece of information for the file system, and that is a mount options description table. Why do you need that at the time when you initialize the file system module? Simple. because parsing the mount options is done by the framework, and you only tell it my specific mount options have those names, and they are, well, mutually exclusive kind of pairs, quota, no quota, or they are kind of option equals value thing, on error equals umount. This is communicated to the framework, and you need it before you actually have a file system instance, so it cannot be made into a VFS operation. A VFS operation operates on an instance, but the mount option parsing is done even before you have a file system instance created for you, so you parse it here. How does this table look like? It's an NMT opt T array, and it just uses, well, names that are either defined in sysmntopt.h or names that you define for your own file system for mount options that are specific to your file system only. You define such cancellation descriptors. Let's say this is a mutually exclusive option, pairs of, well, quota, no quota, large files, no large files, logging, no logging. Such options are mutually exclusive, and if I specify logging, then it cannot at the same time have no logging. And in order to make sure that I get consistent behavior here, I provide those cancellation descriptors here. And I might say MO default. This is a default mount option. Unless the user explicitly specifies something that overrides this, the mount VFS function will be called with a flags value that reflects this option being set. Yeah, so what else do you do? You have this init functionality. I know that this is a little bit unreadable on the video screen. I'm sorry for that. It's just too large to fit on the page otherwise. And it's the init function which does two things. It registers the VFS operations that this file system supports, and it registers the VNOTOPS operations that this file system supports with the respective frameworks. In order to do so, you provide templates for the VFS ops and the VNOTOPS. Templates that just say, okay, I support these VFS operation types, mount, unmount, root, stat VFS, sync, vget, and mount root. The table ends here with a double null pair, and the functions to call within my file system, if someone does a request to mount, a request to sync, a request to vget, are those specified here. You communicate that to the file system by just saying VFS setops to the file system type that was assigned to you. No. Specify the VFS ops template and the UFS VFS ops vector that you wish the framework to initialize for you. Why are we not directly initializing, statically initializing the UFS VFS ops vector? For simple reasons, make this versionable. If we change the VFS ops vector, add a new VFS operation, discard an old one, reorder the elements, change the prototypes of the functions in between, then this additional layer of abstraction allows us to keep binary compatibility. This was introduced in Solaris 10 after we had made some of these changes that broke everything, and we said we don't want to break it again, just keep something that allows us to keep it stable. That is why I have a new abstraction layer here. This didn't used to be like this. The same for the VNOTOPS. We also actually initialize the VNOTOPS from such a template. So we have a similar one that says static const fs operate and def t ufs VNOTOPS template. And that thing contains then vnop underscore open comma ufs open and a long list of these things. and I initialize them as well to get my actual VNodeOps function table vector that is being passed into that is being attached to the VNode data structure later on. That's all. UFS does something else in here, and that's the internal initialization, iInit. What could that be? Well, that's glue code. Keep a hash of all nodes in the file system. Initialize global data structures for the file system. Or essentially, file system node hashes and file system hashes to perform things like a generic sync on all file systems of this type or so. Yeah. That is pretty simple. Now, VNodeOps themselves are more complicated than the VFSOps. There are far more of these. And you can have more than one VNodeOps vector. Why would you want that? Well, you have two options. You can just create one VNodeOps vector and have every node in the file system be handled by that. What's the disadvantage? You will have to do something like in, say, myfs underscore unlink. You have to check, am I unlinking a file or a directory? Unlinking a directory may not be possible if it's not empty. Creating a file within a file definitely is not possible. You can only create a file within a directory. So if I would call GOP create on a file vnode, well, inval. So if you keep a set of VNodeOps vectors that are different between files and directories, then you can keep your code and the actual implementation simpler in the sense that certain VNode operations are only possible if you operate on a directory and others are only possible if you operate on a file. UFS doesn't do that, but other file systems tend to do it like this. PCFS does, for example, and ZFS does extensively. Now, ZFS uses something like 6 or 7 VNode operations vectors or different types of files and under different circumstances. And this, of course, means that the association between the generic file system node, the VNode, and the operations vector on it is dynamic and can be changed. Can be changed even at runtime. So you could transform a file VNode into something that always errors when you access it. Why would you want to do that? Well, for example, forced U-mount or the file system having become hard-locked due to an error or so. It doesn't mean that the VNodes are all gone. Someone may have an open file on that thing, and that in turn means that there's a cached VNode around. But of course, you need to be able to deal with the fact that everything is supposed to error out on this thing. How can you do that? Well, by rewriting the VNode operations on all the VNodes in the errored file system to refer to EIO VNodeOps. So how do I perform VNode initializations and VNode instantiations? Well, simple. The VFS VGET function does that. Create me a node on this file system. VGET is very simple. You have this file system. You have some more or less opaque identification tag for I want this node. And you have a pointer to a VNode that you are supposed to initialize. What is this opaque tag that tells it I want this node? Traditionally, it's the inode number. That's what it is for UFS. So VGET for UFS takes a data structure that just reflects the inode number. And VGET will do what? Well, it will load this inode number information from disk, initialize an in-core inode, attach it to a VNode, activate this VNode by saying vnsetops, provided with an operation vector, and make it known to the framework. In order to actually, the framework will not allocate VNode data structures for you. The framework provides functions, vnalloc VN3 that allow you to allocate and free VNode data structures. And it also provides the VN exists and VN invalid functions that allow you, while keeping the data structure around, to make it visible, usable by the framework. If you have not called VN exists on a VNode data structure, no one will be able to perform any VOP underscore something operation on it. Well, that's what you do there. After that, you have a VNode. The VNode has a file system operations vector attached to it. The VNode has a data pointer attached to it. This data pointer will refer to the file system specific part of it, the UFSI node data structure, the PCFS node structure, whatever. And when you actually want to call file system operations, it will work after VGET is done. Now, that is creating a VNode. How long does the VNode live? When will it go away? How can I actually discard it? Well, the answer to that is it lives as long as it is locked. And if it is unlocked, it's cached until somebody feels the need to discard it, or if somebody forces a discard. How do you lock the VNode? Well, you call VGET, you get the VNode data structure back. After that, you call VNHold. VNHold is a very, very simple function. It's even defined in the header file, I think. It just adds one to a counter in the VNode data structure. After that, the reference count on that thing is up, means it's staying resident, and you can then call an arbitrary sequence of VOP underscore something operations on it. Once you're done with that, call vnrelay, meaning your system call is done. Well, all of this here is multi-threaded. Someone else could have gotten the same VNode, performed another operation. Well, if the reference counters are way up, lots of people performing operations on the same VNodes, and then of course vnrelay is doing nothing but count the reference counter down. And if the reference counter is down, then it will call a function called VOP inactive. This is kind of identical or similar to the way how generic device drivers in Solaris work. You can call open, 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 open. And when you call close on a device, your driver is not being notified of this unless it's the last close. That's how device drivers work. Now on VNodes, VOP open, VOP close are strictly paired, but there's a function that provides this information. This is the last one. All references to this within the framework are gone now, and that's VOP inactive. So once the node can be discarded, once Solaris knows there's no further user of this thing, it will call VOP inactive. And VOP inactive is actually tearing down and freeing the state associated with this VNode. That includes, of course, the file system specific state on this thing. It might include the need to do something like sync the on-disk data structures, for example, to write out a timestamp update or so. And after it's done all that, it will just do a VN invalid and a VN free on the framework provided VNode pointer. This is also new in Solaris 10, because earlier on, in Solaris 9 and 8, none of these VN underscore something service functions existed. You just inlined everything into the file system specific structure. You did something like struct inode, embeds a struct vnode, and followed by the file system specific stuff. The disadvantage here is that we couldn't resize struct vnode if we do this, and we cannot provide separate caching mechanisms for vnodes. So this is why we introduced those service functions. Now vget itself is not a vnode operation. It's a VFS operation. Why? Well, because vnode, a vget does not start with a vnode. VGET operates on the file system itself, and it's a direct hook into metadata. I mean, there's a certain problem here, because the VFS operations are not, especially in the case of VGET, mapped to any system calls. So how does a system call get a VNode? Well, by the implementation of functions like create or lookup, by the implementation of those functions directly calling VGET. Lookup takes a directory VNode, where to start the lookup, a file name, and a pointer to a VNode that it shall return. Now, what does lookup do in an actual implementation? It transforms that file name somehow into an internal representation that the file system understands. This file identifier tag that VGET accepts calls VGET to actually load the metadata from disk, initialize the VNode for it, and return that thing. Similar for a create. So the creation involves disk I/O, and that's done by VGET. And VGET has another task. It has to check, does this thing actually exist? Do I know this in core? Do I actually need to perform I/O in order to do, in order to read it? If so, I'm just going to return the cached one. And otherwise, okay, I do this allocation. What about the freeing? Well, I have this count on the VNode data structure. Do I free the node when the count is 1 or when the count is 0? Well, if there were a standard for file systems, it would define we free it when the count is 0. But the whole point is there is no standard. And so the framework allows both 0 and 1. You will be, your VNode inactivation function will be called once the V count has dropped to 1 or to 0. When can that happen? Well, multi-threading races. So it's an atomic add, but it's still, the VN relay still checks for the count. So it decrements, it does its own decrement, and then it checks, is the count 1, go down. If the count is less than 1, what does it mean? Someone else at this time has done the next decrement before I came to my comparison. Why does it allow both 1 and 0? Because the file system is free to return a node from VGET that is held. So VGET may actually call VNHold on the node. But it may also return a node from VGET that is not held. That is, so that has a ref count of 0. That's a file system implementation detail, and the framework allows both. There's a problem with this reference counting stuff that makes inactive complicated. And this problem with the reference counting stuff is the fact that, well, you're executing your inactive function, and someone does a VNHold. What's happening? Well, the VNHold just adds up the reference counter. The VOP inactive in that case shouldn't proceed. So there are locking issues here that you need to solve. You need to acquire the lock on the VNode data structure explicitly in the inactive function. That is the only place in the file system implementation code where you actually need the VNode lock, because all other operations on the VNode are done on the file system specific part of it, the VNode data pointer field, and that has its own locks. How you implement them is up to you, but the VNode lock itself will be acquired and dropped by the framework as it sees fit. And the only time when you acquire and drop it is in inactive, in order to prevent races with VNHold and VNRelay. So VOP inactive is a function that you absolutely need. You cannot have a functional file system without. What does VOP inactive do? Well, when you create a node allocate the data for it, initialize the structures, then you hash it into a file system node hash of sorts so that you can find it again later. Inactive, of course, needs to, well, flush all potentially still cached data on the node. How do you do that? You call vnhasCachedData. If vnhasCachedData, perform a put page on the thing. Throw out all cached data on that file. The next thing you have to do is remove it from the hashes. How this is done depends on your implementation. And there is no generic node hash in Solaris. So you have to implement your own for your file system. And then you're going to free the data structures. So this is what inactive does. What other VNode operations do you need to implement in order to get a functional file system? Well, you would want to read and write data, don't you? You need to be able to look up files, and you need to be able to do a directory search on it. So do a stat on a file name, do a read dir on parsing directory contents, do I'm going to show not all VNode operations tonight, but only some of them. And the important ones are write and read, get page and put page, and from the VFS side, mount and unmount. We're going to look at these, what they do, starting with read and write. Read and write actually share a lot of code because the generic stuff, am I attempting to read from an offset beyond the end of the file? Am I attempting to read from an offset that is always invalid because, for example, the file system doesn't support files larger than 2 gigabytes? Can I actually read or write from or to that file? Does the permissions on that file allow it, or the ACLs on that file allow it? Am I reading or writing chunks of data that my file system supports? How about, can I read and write, or is this thing quota locked? Checks like that will be performed in the glue code for write, not by the framework. Why not? Because informations about what file offsets are valid for a given file depend on the file system. What can you support? File permissions are strictly dependent on the file system. I mean, a FAT file system has entirely different types of permissions than a UFS file system. Quota support, not every file system supports things like that. This is why, although many file systems have code here that looks extremely similar or even identical, it's not in the framework but in the generic part. Now, after those generic checks, you actually perform the I/O. How do you perform the I/O? It's a loop. It's a loop that starts at the offset specified by the arguments to the write VNode op. And it just says, OK, file system implementation backend BMAP, give me the block that belongs to this file offset. And rather, give me the block list, as many consecutive blocks as there might be. Give me that list. And I'll pass that on into SecMap to actually perform I/O on it. Likewise for write, if I want to write something and I do not find existing blocks at this place, then I will call a function that allocates blocks so that the range offset length that is passed into write will actually have committed backing store to it. The disk layout details in the actual implementation of write itself are hidden, and you're not going to see any function in read or write in the VNode op implementation that does a disk read. That is hidden in BMAP and in BAlloc. Well, a slight problem here is that although you have those BMAP and blog functions in most file systems is the fact that, again, no standard exists. How you transform the UIO data structures that write and read get passed in into stuff that your BMAP extends is up to you. Now, the more interesting part is SegMap. Now, the BMAP gave you a list of this offset corresponds to this disk block and so many consecutive disk blocks. How do you do IO on it? You could just set up a buff data structure as you would do with a normal character block device driver, a buff data structure, and read it in and call copy out to transfer it to the user space end or UIO move. What's the problem with that? Well, we create such a buff data structure and do it and undo the buff data structure again. The other problem is that it's tedious and it might race with memmapped IO. Why? Because memmapped IO is done when you have a page fault and is not calling into the write functionality, but into get page and put page. Now, this idea of having memmapped IO requires us to somehow reroute the two possibilities how you can read from or write to files into the same backend implementation. So what we do not want is, say, someone writing to a file, and we have one code path there that directly accesses the device, and another one writing to that file via memmap, doing page faults, and ending up in a different way of writing to the device. We wouldn't see the same data. So we must make sure that when we access files, it all goes through only one IO code path. And the subsystem in the kernel that is used to perform memmapped IO from within the kernel as a service to write and read VNode operations is SegMap. So SegMap is a kernel segment driver that allows you to create a temporary mapping for IO, for file system IO purposes. It's a bit similar to BP map in, BP map out, but purely kernel internal. So you tell SegMap, I need backing store, a kernel virtual memory address that corresponds to this offset and this length in a file. You call that via segmap getmap. You might actually end up having to create pages for it. When would that be necessary? In case that you write to it for the very first time. The first fault that you do, or the first operation that you do, might not be a read, might be a write. And in that case, segmap getmap can return you data, but it can return you a segmap description that has no pages associated with it. So there has no IO been done to the file yet. In that case, it's your task to call the function that actually creates the page cache information associated with this file, create actual virtual memory pages. Like my page create, and then you perform IO. And you perform IO just by calling UIO move. UIO move for a read from the segmap pages into the UIO move target buffer, for a write from the UIO move target buffer into the segmap map pages. This will cause page faults. This will cause page faults, and the actual page fault handler, segmap fault, will then call get page or put page for this file system. So we, by a trick, reroute write and read vectored IO into memmapped IO. Once you've done that, you release the locks on the pages. So getmap locks down that range of pages so it cannot go away while you perform IO. The page unlock stuff releases the locks on those pages, and the segment release stuff releases segment information stuff that the segment driver has been using. So you temporarily create IO mappings and tear them down again, and the actual IO implementation is now done by get page, put page. These are the two most complicated functions in every file system. Why? Because unfortunately we have not created a framework function for it. GetPage and PutPage are called with a vNode on which to perform I/O. The information, this offset, so and so many bytes, the protection, the page protection information, where the page is readable, writable, executable, that this segment of memory that I'm faulting in is supposed to use as the prot pointer. It's being passed a page list, fill me those pages, a size of that page list. A page list is an array of page pointers. Page list size tells me so and so many pages I want to fill in. A framework can call get page and put page on 1,000 pages at the same time, would have to be broken down there. A virtual memory segment, and kernel address on which those page lists are mapped to, and whether it's a read-write fault or a read fault or a creation fault. So very first access to a page, if it's a read, it's a read fault. If it's a write, it's a write fault. A creation fault is something that, like zeroing out the page without ever having done any other different kind of access. And the get page function in the file system just checks, is it only one page? I call the get a page thing directly. Otherwise, I call an iterator, PVN, paged vNode support, an iterator that just takes all the parameters and a function to call for one page. So the PVN get pager stuff does for page equals PL, go ahead, call put a page, get a page, next page, and so on. And the actual implementation is in get a page, put a page, which is the equivalent of get page, put page, just for one page, one MMU page. The structure of this thing is always something like the ones shown here. This is actually from PCFS, and this is glue code. It has no file system specific information in there at all. You will see exactly the same code structure if you look at HSFS getter page, for example. You will see very much similar code structure if you look at UFS getter page, except that UFS getter page has so many optimization hooks that it's completely unreadable. What does it do? Well, you request from the framework, can I do write concatenation? So I might be only reading one page, but I can do a continuous read if the framework actually has more than one page to do. It's called one page, but you're still able to fill in 50 pages at once as long as there are 50 contiguous pages there. So this is why you call this thing, and it gives you an offset to start and a length to perform the operation for. And this will essentially go back to the page list information that went into get page and reconcatenate it so that you can perform clustered I/O, and the caller, the iterator, the PVN get pages will not have to call you too often as long as you can perform the I/O continuously. Now, you perform the I/O continuously, of course, only if you can. Otherwise, you have to break it down. And you have to iterate over the pages. Partial pages, page offset equals null, page offset less than page size, and transfer offset less than what the size of the file is. Well, partial transfers are being done if you request filling only second half of a page. Partial transfers are also done if the file is smaller than a multiple of a page size, because then you are not reading from beyond the end of the file. You increase the offset within the page by the number of bytes that you transfer, which is usually file system block size of sort. And you increase the logical block number, which is what the file system deals with, disk blocks, disk block numbers, by, well, how many disk blocks you put into your transfer size thingy. And the actual I/O here is done via page I/O setup, BDEV strategy, BIO wait, page I/O done. There is glue code that is being called in here, which is what? Well, up there, in between the read cluster call and the main loop that does the iteration, you will translate by calling bmap from the actual offsets, file offsets that get pages passed in, into disk blocks. You will also strip down, you will also perform block allocations if this is a get page for a read fault that has no backing yet. File systems with holes might encounter this situation. If a file system supports holes, then what can happen is you memmap the file, and your first access to something in there is a write to an area that maps to a hole. What will happen? Well, that write first will cause a write get page fault. Why does it call get page first? Well, you modify a byte in a page. You're not changing the entire page at once. It means you first have to read in the entire page. Then your memmapped access can change the one byte. And then eventually you need to put page it out. So even a write access will always cause first a read page fault, but one that might need to do block allocation. You do this in here. You get your page, your buff structure here. You fill in the buff structure with the actual information. Get me this disk block, so and so many bytes. Put the output, the address here. That's the stuff that you got from SegMap. That's an actual kernel virtual address here. And then perform the strategy call. This populates the backend for the data. It can be asynchronous or not. Then you have to do some hints to the system about statistics. ProcFS keeps I/O statistics per process, so and so many blocks being written by the file by this process. In order to keep those statistics correct, you have to call lwstatupdate on the number of blocks that you wrote here. If you're clustering blocks, reading adjacent blocks, reading more than one disk block at a time, you would just call larger numbers here. And done. After that, if you have only read in a partial page, like at the end of a file, you have to zero out the remaining part so that the user of a memmap will not be able to see strange data trailing files. And after that, you call the plist_init function, which does what? Well, the read cluster here, as I said, will check the page list that getPage gets to see how many consecutive pages do I have, and whether I can perform I/O on a whole row of them. If so, I do it, and having performed this I/O, I need to reconstruct the page lists so that the iterator will know there's no more need to call me. Everything's done already. And the communication back to the PVN get pages iterator here is done by calling the calling the plist init function. I'm going to go through get page from the actual PCFS file system in detail to show you exactly where do I do the disk block locations. I'm going to show you this just as an example of how it looks like in reality. And after that, I'm going to show you the only other place where we do disk I/O into user buffers, and that is, reading directories, performing a read dir operation. Looks a bit different. So the getPage function takes a vnode pointer, fold me in something from this vnode, the following offset, so and so many bytes, protection stuff. This address is my actual kernel virtual address for this fold. If you want to write something, do it there. The secRW parameter says whether it's a read, create, or write fold. So this thing just does generic checks, some error in there. If the vnode is actually flagged as this is something you cannot mmap, when can a vnode be flagged as this? Well, if it's, for example, a pipe or a FIFO node, things like that you cannot mmap. In that case, you will have that nmap flag set there. And in that case, the attempt to fold something in on that just returning no support for it. You are locking your node. PCFS does this in a very simple way. So the framework does not lock your node for you anyway. If you want to fence against traces here, do your own locking. And then you call the iterator, get a page. You call it directly if you fold in less than a page, and you let the iterator call it if you did that. And the actual implementation is here. Now we start, initialize the page list with to start with a zero first. And we check permissions. Have we accessed it before? Well, we are accessing it now. So we need to record a timestamp update. That's one thing. Access timestamps. If it's a read-only file system, no, we're not going to do it. Check that we need to do. And then we check, is this cached? Has somebody already folded this in? Well, can happen. When? If two processes memmap the same file and they get a page fault on it at the same time, one of them is going to be faster. We'll have done the fold in, and after that, the page cache will hold a page that has this data. And the only thing we now need to do if it is there is to reassociate it with stuff that we want. If that's not the case, then we actually need to read it from the disk. The way how we do it is we call, block number. This is a block number, LBN, relative to the file. So it just converts offset in bytes to how many file system blocks this is. It's just a division. The more interesting part is a little bit later on. Offset within that block is, of course, just the remainder of the division. Looks strange. Transfer offset, PCFS uses something else, but here, why? Because PCFS has clusters and sectors sectors as being the unit of I/O that the device can do, and cluster being the unit of allocation that the FAT file system does. UFS has something similar to that. Device blocks and file system blocks. File system blocks being the granularity at which you can allocate space in a file, and device blocks being the granularity with which you can access data on a block device. So you perform the calculations how much in the current one. Then you do that clustering part, which gets you a pointer to a page. PP is a pointer to a page data structure, and you need that later on. If it's null, then this means somebody has discarded I'm unmapped, I'm synced it, invalidated it, while you are performing this operation. PCFS is dump, it will panic there. Why? Because the locking of PCFS is so that you can only perform I/O on one node at one time. UFS here has code that will unspool the page list and start rereading from the very start of the offset. Then we iterate here, starting with the page offset, saying, okay, when we are done with the whole page, get the next one. We check how many blocks do we have to read. What is the block that we operate on at the moment? What is the offset within the block that we operate on? Then we translate these, the logical block number, into an actual physical block number. The BMAP function here performs disk I/O. Look up the metadata and find where on disk are disk blocks for this offset. Once we have that in UFS, we just call UFS BMAP here. Once we have that, we create our buff, device to read from, block number. Well, the block number that we get from BMAP plus plus what? Simple. The get page operation operates on a page. You are doing I/O within the file system on basis of file system blocks. If they are larger than a page, you might be reusing, not calling BMAP, but reusing the information here in order to get the next page from within the same block. This is inefficient how PCFS does it. UFS does that in one go. The address is the offset within the page. The vnode that this is associated with is the vnode. And then you call strategy, which will perform the actual I/O to the device. This is really reading from the device then. After that, you call BIO wait, page I/O done. Zero out the trailing part. You tell the file system what exactly you have read. After that, if there was an error, you need to call read done in order to release the page list here. And otherwise, you can return. Now, if in initial you found the page, then it's cached and you don't have to reread it. In that case, you just lock it. Page lookup, as he shared, says, make it permanent because now there is a consumer. So this is the generic structure, and everyone uses this. If I you can essentially copy that. It's using the same generic structure. perform me those block offset thingy, a count of blocks, convert the sizes that you request into things that the file system understands. HSFS reads interleaves. Then you have the main loop. If page found, page exists. So all of this is file system specific glue code. Page exists, PVN read cluster. Get your IO offset thingies from the read cluster stuff. Well, initialize some. So this does more than PCFS, not one buffer at a time, but several buffers at a time. That's possible. Nonetheless, you initialize your buffers, what to read from, where to read from, and you do submit the IO right here, video strategy. You do the updates on the stats. You might do the BIO weights. You do the read done if there was an error, free the page list. In case for having found it, if not, we will communicate back to the framework about what we actually have read. So you see that the actual implementation here can be quite complicated, but all of this is in the file system specific glue code. The skeleton for this is the same all the time. And it's one of the most unfortunate things that we have no framework function that contains the skeleton. Well, we don't, so that's the way it is. Now, put page works exactly the same way. There's also this put up page function. And for HSFS, there's nothing there because HSFS is read only. But for PCFS, there of course is. This writes the contents of a page back to disk. And it starts with the same kind of things. Get me information about whether I can do clustering, write out more than one page at the same time. Then start with the loop that iterates over the page, partial transfers, translate between block offsets within the file, logical block numbers that are consecutive, and actual physical block numbers that might not be. Create me some buff. Well, whether I directly allocate them and initialize them as HSFS did, or whether I use page IO setup for it remains up to me. Fill it, call beta strategy to perform the actual IO, update the stats, and perform the unallocation of that buffer. For put page, you always call PVN write done. Why? Because put page, one of the tasks that put page performs is invalidation. So if this was a write page fault, I perform it in order to be able to release the files afterwards, the pages afterwards anyway. I only write back if there's either an explicit request to write it back, if fsflush happens to walk over the page and write it back, or if I want to invalidate the page, make it available again. After a write, the pages are always released in the sense that they are still in the page cache, but available for other reuses if memory need is pressing. This is why you always call PVN write done, not only for the error case, but always. For read, this might not be the case. Yeah. Now, this stuff talks about read ahead. Well, that's another one of these things which the framework only does to a certain degree. But normally you would expect that the framework does the read ahead things for you and just tells you via proper GET page calls, well, please read me some more than there actually is. No, that's not the case for Solaris. If you want file read ahead, want to have information cached that will only be folded in later, or even cache information that nobody has already requested to fold in, and you have to do that on your own in an implementation, in your implementation of GET page and PUT page. How do you do that part? Well, don't. Read the UFS implementation. UFS does this, and it's kind of horrid, because missing a standard for this, how do you perform read ahead? UFS does it very simple. It retains an information in the inode, in core inode structure that says the last read was from this and we read so and so much. So if the next fault comes along and finds, okay, I already read what I want to fold in this time, then I can just find it in the cache. But the disadvantage here that this only handles one read ahead stream per file. Now ZFS, for example, attaches the read ahead information not to the file system node, but to thread specific data instead. Thread specific data contains an information about this thread has done so and so many bytes read ahead. That allows multiple read ahead streams per file. But of course, again, complicates the implementation. So the implementation details of read ahead are not provided by the framework, but by the actual backend implementation. Now, user data I/O, we've seen where we do it. Where do we do metadata I/O? Well, in VGET, if I want to read a node from disk and identify what information belongs to this, I perform metadata I/O from within VGET. Where else do I perform metadata I/O? BMAP. BMAP might need to parse block lists, the on-disk data layout information, in order to find what block matches a certain file offset. Or BMAP does metadata I/O. Who else does metadata I/O? Lookup. Finding what file system node belongs to a certain file name in a directory. Must parse the directory. Who else must parse the directory? Read dir. It's also metadata I/O. Where does metadata I/O? Well, block allocation, block free. If I perform, if I grow a file, I need to update the metadata of the file so that it reflects the new blocks that are allocated for it, and I need to update the metadata records, the actual block lists that say this block is now allocated. How do I perform metadata I/O? I've seen it perform user data I/O via SegMap, and the get page, put page backends actually fold it in and directly call BDEV strategy. Now I can perform metadata I/O in the same way. I could create my own buffs for it and call BDEV strategy on it, but that is not something we traditionally do, because traditionally for metadata, Unix has had the metadata buffer cache. The buffer cache is something that is only used for metadata in Solaris, and it's the functions bread, bwrite that get something from the buffer cache and that put something into the buffer cache. Who uses it? Well, BMAP, for example, so we can check that. So the BMAP function for PCFS, for example, takes a file system specific node, a logical cluster number, a file system block number. This could just as well be simply an offset into the file. PCFS has decided to convert byte offsets into block numbers first. The disk block number that matches this offset, and the number of contiguous bytes that you will find at this disk block. So, lots of calculations, lots of glue. And then a function that is called pcgetCluster. Now, PCFS here is a bad example because it caches all this stuff actually in core. A getCluster performing the actual read from the metadata block lists, which contain the information about what block is where. Directories. Look at what readdir does. What is the task of the readdir VNOP? It converts file system specific directory entries into Unix dirends. That's what it does. So the Unix dirend is what you get from the readdir system call, an array of these being read into a user buffer of those. This guy does the conversion by performing a loop starting at some block, checking what block is at, what disk block is actually at this offset. And then block off. Which again performs the BMAP and then the BRead. That reads the metadata. That reads the metadata, the directory record, puts it in the buffer cache. It's being kept there so that the next BRead will actually not perform physical I/O, but will find it. And the buffer cache buffers those buffs that you are returned by BRead or BWrite, they are locked in the same way how FreeBSD buffer cache locking works. So the buff has a semaphore, and when you access buffers, when you create request buffers via BRead, the buffer is returned with the buffer semaphore locked, and every other guy who wants to read the same buffer will have to wait until you call BRLs. You can use that for file system locking to serialize changes to the file metadata. You can actually use the buffer cache semaphore lock as a lock on your file system node structure. This is what FreeBSD, for example, does. It doesn't have a lock on the file system structure, on the file system node structure, the, well, UFS inode structure, the PCFS node structure. Instead, it uses the buffer semaphore. You can do the same in Solaris. So you have those mechanisms in there. In order to release that lock, you call BRLs. BRead is extremely simple to use. Read me from this device, this block number, and so many bytes. Well, why do we not use that for user data? Because the buffer cache is a limited resource and the page cache is not. The buffer cache takes up kernel memory, and the page cache does not take up kernel memory. So we separate. We have a different mechanism, SECMAP, for user data than for metadata. Well, let's look at something else here, and that is read, dir, and lookup. They are, of course, doing the same things. Lookup requests me to identify a V node for a given file name in a given directory. Read dir parses the entire directory and returns me the file names. Well, what does lookup do? It parses the entire directory, checks if every file name that I find in there identical to the one that I'm looking for. That means the actual parsing code for directories is both in lookup and in read dir. And we see that. So read dir is an endless loop that reads something, reads the file names, just as long as I can do I/O. Lookup calls a function dir look in order to identify me that thing, returns. Now what does dir look do? Again, v0ops, simple wrapper, dir, the actual implementation. Find entry. Which performs an endless loop that will look very, very, very similar to what read dir does, except that it doesn't copy the stuff out, but instead it compares match file name, long file name, short file name in the case of PCFS. It compares the file name that it found at this slot in the directory with the other one. In my point of view, this is another case where the framework has deficits. Because what do you expect? Well, I expect something like read dir and this to share code. Both of them walk directories. I also would expect that looking up a name in a directory and entering a name in a directory would share code, because the things walking a directory is always the same. Now, it is, of course, possible to structure the code in such a way. Why do Solaris file systems not do that? History, of course. It has always been this way. We never have bothered to actually think much about a file system framework because the only consumer is UFS. It's not documented, so why do something proper? And that's not staying like this all the time. If you look at this code in ZFS, what ZFS actually does is something very proper. It defines directory iterators. So you can say, start an iteration on this directory, advance me to iterator to the next one, do a callback function on that thing, advance me the iterator to the next one, and so on. Finish a directory walk operation. So ZFS is something that's called directory walks. And there's a different, the directory walk is always the same, but in one case, you are looking for used entries for read, dir, and lookup. For create, you're looking for unused entries or free entry. Entering a file name. For rename, you would look for a free entry. The idea is to have this in OpenSolaris in June, July. At the moment, the best source for how to write file system code that shares code between functions that should share it is ZFS. The file system that has the most functionality in it is UFS. The file system that is simplest but horribly buggy and horribly inefficient is PCFS. So you need to read the file system source code in order to get an idea of how these glue codes work. Well, I think there are questions. Otherwise, what I can do is I can show lots of detailed examples how the VNode operations and the VFS operations are implemented. But essentially, I've shown you how the framework works, how the implementation for your file system is done. How do I mount a file system? Well, I request the mount option parsing from the framework. I check, are those mount options something that are valid for me? Am I actually able to access the device that I'm able to that I wish to mount? Is the stuff that I read from this device a file system of my sort? So I read something from there, try to parse a super block, try to identify, is this everything consistent? If not, just throw the mount request out. Otherwise, I've done the mount, so I will hash my file system into my list of file systems that are mounted of this type. I will possibly pre-create some the root node information, for example, read that in, so it's cached, pre-create some other per file system instance situation, return. On unmount, you undo all this stuff. Syncing file systems. Well, I iterate my hash of file systems of my type and perform a call on the VOP sync function for every node that I have for this file system. So all of this is pretty much simple to read, and you can just use file system template code. The complicated parts, I read, write, dir enter, dir remove. What else is complicated about file systems? And the locking stuff. A read-only file system can get by without locking. A read-write file system, you need to devise a locking strategy for the VNode operations there. What do you need to lock, and what do you need to guard against? Well, all of the VNode operations stuff is re-entrant, so it can be called at an arbitrary amount of parallelism. So, writing to a file, if you record information in the file node structure about where you write to or what the last block read was, something like that, you need locks on the node to protect this information. You need to protect, like, a running read dir against a running remove dir. So if I read from a directory, then I can remove it. I cannot remove while I read the directory. I cannot remove files within that directory. I cannot remove a file if somebody actually performs IO into that file at that very moment. How do you come up with a locking strategy for this? It's again not trivial. PCFS does something which is completely brain dead. Have a fair file system instance lock and acquire that whenever you perform a VNode operation. So single thread everything. Do you know how you can trivially crash your machine with PCFS? Mount two PCFS file systems, copy file A to from file system A to file B and file system B, and do something. So copy one file from file system A to file system B and another file from file system B into file system A. It immediately leads to a deadlock. Because of what? Because of the SECMAP stuff. The PCFS write functionality says lock me the file system on which I perform the write. I'm copying from a PCFS file system, which means I do a VOP get page on that thing, which wants to lock the file system on the other side, reading from that thing. So both file systems are locked while I perform a file copy. So if I try to perform another file copy, it's also locked. Now, because those locks are dropped and reacquired as the get page proceeds page-wise, they will eventually cross each other. You'll get a nice panic from that. So this is why the simple locking design, make it all single-threaded, cannot work. So you need a more complicated locking design. You need to have per-node locks. Per-node locks for updating inodes and for reading and writing directories. You might need to have logs for protecting block lists or super block information, metadata that is less granular than per node, per directory. All of this is file system specific. It is quite hard to come up with a locking scheme that is fully generic here. I don't know if anyone, if the Linux people have managed to do that. The BSD folks have not. The UFS locking scheme actually is pretty good, but unfortunately it's also pretty complicated because UFS uses so many locks. Even an inode in UFS has three different locks. The truth is somewhere in between. And truth is somewhere in between. My decision for how to perform node locking will be that I create a per file system instance locks, instance lock for directory operations and a per node lock for file operations. Why that? Because then I can perform the action like this. I have a file operation which will make me lock the directory operation stuff for reading. Then I will lock my file, and then I will perform my arrow to the file. Why do I lock the directory, the file system instance for directory reading only? Because then nobody can discard the file system node under my ass without me knowing. Because then nobody can do something like a rename a file name that I just somewhere else running a create for. If I do not single thread directory manipulations, then the directory locking protocol becomes extremely complicated. So UFS does not single thread directory locking operations. But I think for a file system that you only want to read and write to and not do high performance, high concurrency operations on terabytes of small files, it's actually good enough to do what UFS used to do 5 years ago, single thread directory update informations. If you have a read-writer lock for directory operations, acquire it read only on all vnode ops and on ops that just read from directories, look up read dir. All of those can run concurrently, no problem. But if you actually want to remove files and update directory contents, acquire the directory rename lock, the file system rename lock, exclusively, block out everyone for the duration, be done with it. That's the most simple locking strategy that I can come up with. It's not the most performant one, but it's by far the most simple one. So that is my suggestion for locking. Protect every node, every file with its own lock, and protect against rename races with a per file system instance rename lock. Well, other questions? I didn't talk about the DNLC. Look at UFS. There are some functions, DNLC underscore something that it calls. It's quite obvious.
Huh? Is the maximum block size limited by page size? Or I think you mentioned it once, but I'm not sure.
No.
You can have blocks spanning multiple pages.
You can. It's just that the virtual memory subsystem will call if you use PVN get pages. And PVN get pages will call the get up page function that you pass in once per page.
Right.
So in order to perform the operations efficiently, you don't read more than one MMU page, even if you could, unless read clustering or write clustering tells you you can read more because I want more. Otherwise, you just read one. You can read more if you know that.
But that's the read ahead stuff. I'm talking about matching the like, example Linux. That's a limitation. In Linux, you can have a file system with the block size bigger than the current page sizes.
Yes.
So on Intel 86,
you can have that on Solaris. but you might need to break your I/O down nonetheless, depending on how you implement getpatch.
Oh yeah. So yeah, you're right.
You can read more than page size if your file system has continuous entities that are larger than that. The question is, where do you stuff that? So if you do a read ahead, where do you put the data that has not been requested by this fault?
Into a patch cache.
And how do you do that?
Yeah, the whole point is that in order to do this, you have to create pages in the page cache temporarily. UFS does this, and UFS get page function is far more complicated than the PCFS one.
Lines PVN get pages, and it does read ahead. So this is not an async request to fold something in, and this has a specific function for the read ahead stuff. And the read ahead stuff where does it create my page lists? Exactly. I need to create pages in the page cache on my own if I read ahead to somewhere where there's no backing for. So if I read ahead blindly because there's no request to actually fill some I/O buffer with the information, then I need to create pages on my own which contain this information then. The VM subsystem normally will do the page creation via segmap. So when you call segmap getmap, segmap page create, it will do the page creation stuff for you. And in which way? Well, it will associate a virtual address in the kernel with page structure and with a physical page of sorts. The problem with PageCreate VA is that you need to find out what is this adder supposed to be, where can I put it temporarily. And I don't understand this code completely. I don't. I just have to copy what UFS does with respect to handling the read ahead. The UFS getPage function is split into read ahead getPage and fault miss getPage. And both perform similar operations, though not exactly the same. And the read ahead one updates the read ahead I/O information. As I say, this is obscure. It should be in the framework. It is not. It is in the implementation. So if you want read ahead, the only indication that a read ahead is wanted by the caller of getPage is if you don't pass in a page list. If you don't pass in a page list, it's a read ahead request. The simplest way of handling it, return done. Because you will get a page list if there's actual backing store available for it. If you want to implement it, you have to create your own stuff, and I can only suggest copy the way UFS does it. I don't have any better suggestion there.
Could you estimate how much effort is it to take the sources from the Linux of, let's say, X2 or X3 and port them into Solaris in percentage?
Well, in my opinion,
X2 is not that difficult. X2 should take 4 or 5 weeks, maybe. X3 is a bigger problem because Linux for logging file systems shares transactional code out in that journaling block device driver function. So in order to perform a logging transaction on a log in Linux, you call those JBOT service functions. You don't have these in Solaris. So in order to implement X3, you would have to implement the log reader and the X3 style transaction somehow. So you need to port the Linux JBOT and driver as well. I think XFS is not. Is XFS using JBOT? But RISOFS and X3FS are, and JFS are. So those three share the transactional code. Yes. Well, XFS had not only been developed before by SGI, but also the Linux ports had mostly been done by the SGI folks. And they have not necessarily cared on attempting to share as much as possible with the other guys, like Hans Reiser is doing with RISOFS4, everything his own, and don't try to share things. So that the other Linux file systems always try to share framework code as much as possible, while XFS and RISOFS4 are different there because they more or less follow the Solaris approach, like my file system is my file system. So it's difficult to say how long it will take to port it. XFS, if I would have to port XFS to Solaris, I wouldn't start with the Linux sources, but I would start with the IRIX sources that SGI has released. Because IRIX is a System 5 Unix kernel, and the VNode interfaces are far more similar in the System 5 IRIX kernel to the System 5 Solaris kernel than between Linux and the Solaris kernel. But there are still plenty of differences. As I say, the most trivial things to port are probably FreeBSD file systems, because FreeBSD also uses VFS and VNode ops in a very similar way to Solaris, except that in a way very, very similar to Solaris, except that FreeBSD VNode operations don't take like 12 arguments, just one argument per operation, just a node and an argument type that encodes the rest. So the conversion from a FreeBSD file system to a Solaris file system is almost trivial. Even the buffer cache functions and the buffer cache locking, bread, write, and so on, is exactly the same. FreeBSD has some semi-generic beam mapping mechanism that you don't have in exactly the same way as in Solaris, but porting that over is still not difficult. What sometimes is difficult is the fact that kernel synchronization objects, mutexes, read-writer locks, conditioning variables, semaphores, this kind of stuff is a bit different between BSDs and Solaris. But there still can be an equivalent found for every type of Solaris lock with a BSD lock, and for every type of a BSD lock manager lock with a combination of Solaris locks and condition variables. So if you really want to port file systems to Solaris, if you have a choice, start with a BSD implementation. It's far, far closer in the code than the Linux implementation. Even down to things like FreeBSD has PVN and page IO setup and all the functions that we use, because all this stuff is the same in 4.4 BSD and System 5.
Why didn't some consider the creation of ZFS as a good opportunity to create a new file system framework?
Because ZFS is only one file system. And Sun isn't planning to add a huge amount of new file systems. It's laziness. It's laziness. Creating a new file system framework requires you to convert all the file systems that exist to use the framework. Now, that would have put a burden on the CFS group that the CFS group couldn't have borne, meaning not only writing ZFS and creating it, but also creating an interface, creating the framework and converting UFS to that. We have no resources anywhere to do such an extensive surgery on UFS. It's a pity, of course it's a pity. It's one of those things, the file system framework is one of those things where Brian Kendrell's notion about what's a pile in the Solaris code really fits.
Does that imply that the strategy of Solaris is to go with ZFS and forget everything else for the future?
As the main file system, it's definitely ZFS, yes. I mean, we have communicated that clearly enough. But there will always be the need for third-party file systems. I mean, UFS is there, and it's not there to die from now to the next day. Why? Because there are petabytes of data on UFS out there, and people are not going to convert everything to ZFS if they have their old data and they upgrade the system. They're going to retain that on UFS, at least for a while. Also, PCFS, for example, the FAT file system has gotten kind of a revival that no one had expected 10 years ago. It's more present than ever. USB media are using it everywhere. Memory cards, the file system on your iPod is FAT. The file system on your digital camera is a FAT. So being able to read FAT file systems, it's not going to away anytime soon, although I would give an arm and a leg if it did. But the same is probably true for NTFS. Being able to read NTFS media is something that is sorely lacking in Solaris. It's absolutely something that we want to have as soon as possible. NFS, I mean, NFS is a file system, of course, and it's not going away, definitely not. So there are other file systems that you cannot replace by ZFS. Because either you don't control the media that these are used on, you just have to support them, or because they address an entirely different thing, like NFS. And then there are, of course, pseudo file systems, ProcFS and ObjectFS and FDFS and NameFS, a huge amount of these things. But those pseudo file systems are implemented in entirely different ways, and we actually have a decent framework for creating pseudo file systems. It's GFS stuff. So it's all only disk-based file systems where the amount of code sharing could be larger than it is at the moment. And they're only, well, new ones. So I can see that eventually we will probably have a get page implementation that is more generic, because this huge amount of glue code in get page, where you iterate over the page and over partial stuff and so on, we could instead just have the file system communicate to the framework, hey, my file system block size is this, and or call this function to determine that thing, and just source the get page stuff out, and essentially just have a generic get page call a few service functions about doing the block mapping directly. We might eventually see this, but when somebody starts working on it and has enough of time. I mean, it's not that it's not working. The way how you implement new file systems is usually you copy the code from an old one, strip out all the file system specific stuff, leave the generic stuff in, and just fill it in again with the new ones. This is how traditionally people have gone, and they have also copied much of the bugs of UFS and going and doing so. Yeah.
The part where you are talking about copy in and copy out, where this is actually happening, the question is, does my file system has access to the user data?
Yes, it does. It does that. So this is the place where it does it. which function is this? This is UFS code, and it's either rip or rdip. So write an inode or read an inode. It actually is rip, write an inode. So this is the UFS implementation. UIO move is a documented function. Takes four parameters, an address, number of bytes to transfer, whether this is a write or a read, and a struct UIO that describes the target. This is documented. Kernel drivers can use that to perform user space IO. So the UIOT is passed as an argument to the VNOD op. The VOP write gets a UIOT. Write me from the file into that UIOT. That's what I do there. And the actual IO is done by copying. So the UIO move will just do a block copy from this kernel virtual address, base plus mebon, into the UIO structure. Essentially, if you look at the implementation of UIO, I think it only says k copy from this address for so and so many bytes. How do you get this base address here? Here, via segmap. So you create yourself an address in the kernel, a kernel virtual memory address, which will have the data, which will be used to put the data that you read from the file in. Getmap fault, because the request here is to read this in if it isn't there, calls false. Now the fault, if you look at this thing here, segmap getmap fault, this is the thing that you call. And guess what this thing does? After a lot of interesting looking, it will do I have a flow diagram for that, which covers a DIN A2 page. I can't show you that. I don't have it here, unfortunately. Look for that. Yeah, there we are. So after having done all the stuff that it needs for the segmented thingy, it calls vop get page. It calls vop get page. And vop get page will call then into, well, UFS get page to actually read the disk IO directly into these mapping buffers. So what happens is your IO move copies from this kernel virtual address, gets a fault. Segmap get map, segmap fault will read the page in by calling the file system's VOP get page function, performs all the disk IO stuff. After that, the fault will return. UIO move will now be restarted, the copy operation, will perform the copy until the next page is encountered. Next fault, read it in, UIO move will continue, and so on. The write and the read stuff does I/O in the memapped way. UIO move essentially is the same as doing memcopy. So if you do memcopy in user land from some buffer into a file, you're performing a write. If you do a memcopy from the memapped file into some buffer, you're performing a read. That's exactly what the kernel file system implementation does internally via segmap. And the actual I/O is done from the fault handlers called as a consequence of the action of what UIO move does. Now, this is possible to show. I mean, how do you show such things? Okay, I think this should do. Sorry, I forgot. Exactly. Well, you need to be rude. I haven't allowed my ordinary users to do dtrace. Okay, so there you see that fun. Where do you do actual disk I/O from within UFS? Well, this is logging UFS, and most of it is actually done for log accesses. Where are those page faults that we are really interested in? This is the code path here. I perform a write system call going into UFS write, going into RIP, which is the most implementation-specific backend stuff, going into segmap release. Well, why not in the UIO move itself? Because the target for the UIO move is present, and the source for the UIO move is also present, has been pre-faulted. The UIO move will succeed here, but the segmap release here will actually have to write, call the put page. It does put page, put pages, put up page, and do the write strategy from here. We should be able to get a read as well. Here, for example, we're doing a read ahead via some entirely different code paths. This is a read ahead on lock writes, actually. Let me see. What? Time over, far over. So explore those things on your own. I mean, that's what it is for. Okay, I know I've been confusing at times. I apologize for that. I've only been back from a long holiday on Friday, and I've not slept enough. Oh, enjoy the beers afterwards, I would say.
We need some beers tonight as well.
Yeah? Yeah.
Last question. Single word answer enough. Is it all right to do
walking inside of the get pages function?
What do you mean by blocking? I mean you are blocking in get page if you do IO. It's not okay to hold locks in get page. So while you perform IO, while you call BDEV strategy, the node should not be locked. If that is the case, you might run into strange problems. Oh, how much overtime have I been this time?
2 hours or something.
Yeah.